Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We reset the phone, so I think they're probably going to work now. Some folks are on the line, but you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. If we dropped you earlier, we didn't mean to. Sorry about that. We really want your call, 888-318-7884. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do this hour. Thomas is screening the calls, and he's writing down for us what the questions are. So if I get to the caller and I can't hear you or what, or just there's even a little bit of trouble, I'm just going to read your question for Joe. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer, an apologist here at Catholic Answers, an apologist extraordinaire, the author of a bunch of books, including Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. And you can ask him anything. Whether you're Catholic or not, you can ask him whatever you'd like about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. You did come back, right, Joe?
I did.
You did? Oh, and we got this connection is working. Do you connect to us using a Comrex, or are you using like Skype, or how do you do it?
I'm using Skype.
Oh, you're using Skype. Well, that sounds good.
If I'm being honest, I don't know what a Comrex is.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad. Finally, I found something Joe Heschmeyer doesn't know. All right. Comrex is a little black box that costs about $3,000.
I like that you thought I might have been using that. I think you've greatly overestimated
yeah, right.
How much I make.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't know how we had set you up. I mean, it makes for very, very good sound. But this voice over the internet is getting so good that you really almost don't need it. I mean, you sound great on Skype.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Oh, man, this is a beautiful moment we're sharing. 888-318-7884, the number. So we can't get the phones to work, so we said, well, let's just have Theo come in and ask a question. I mentioned Theo the first hour, visiting with us here from Auburn Hills, Michigan. And we know Theo from years of coming to the conference and being one of our supporters, which we're very grateful for.
Yes.
Am I allowed to say you're a graduate of West Point? Or
I did not graduate West Point, but I did teach at West Point.
Oh, you taught at West Point. Oh, I thought you were a West Point grad.
No.
You taught. That's even better.
Yeah. I went to University of Michigan. Go Blue.
Okay. Well, good for you. Congratulations on that. but you're an engineer.
Yes.
And there's a lot of engineering at West Point.
Yes, there is.
I didn't know
that.
It's like an engineering school.
Yeah, it was just founded as an engineering school.
Oh, yeah.
That's why Jefferson signed off on it. It was because he needed engineers to go out to the new territories. And it's like, oh, well, this will get me some engineers.
Oh, well, good for Thomas Jefferson. I'm glad to hear that. All right, Theo, I'm really glad you're here. It's just great to see you again because it feels like we have not seen the people that we always look forward to seeing for just so long.
Yes, I have found out I'm not quite as much an introvert as I once thought.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have found that out. Oh, I actually do need the company of other people. All right, go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer, Theo.
Yes, so Joe, if a pitcher in baseball intends to deceive the batter, such as throwing a changeup and trying to make it look like a fastball, is this lying and therefore sinful?
I love that question. The answer is no. The easiest way to explain why the answer is no is that the definition of lying is speaking a falsehood with the intention of deceiving, and you're not speaking anything as a pitcher. But I think the heart of your question actually goes deeper, that when you're in the context of a game and there's no expectation of the other person telling you accurate information, it doesn't seem like we're in the realm of truth and lying in that, you know. So if you say in poker, I've got a great hand and you have nothing, that's probably also fine and morally acceptable, because that's different than like telling the IRS, I didn't make any money this year when you did. Like, one of those is actually lying in the moral sense, and the other, you're playing a game. Likewise, if you're performing a part in a movie or something like that, and you're saying things that aren't true, that's not a moral act. And that, you know, when we're talking about lies, we don't mean games. We mean like actually deceiving someone. Now, having said that, you will find theologians who say a jocose lie, which is a lie told in jest, like when you troll someone, like tricking them for a joke, a lie where the purpose of it is humor, that you can find them saying that is a sin, but still a minor one. That's different than when you make it very clear. Like if I say a priest and a rabbi walk into a bar, like no one thinks I'm telling the truth there and I'm not trying to deceive. But there are other times where you're like, oh no, your car is on fire, and it's not, and you're trying to trick them. They would say that's a small, probably a venial sin. there's differences of opinions on that. But to the heart of your question, like, no, trying to deceive a batter with a pitch is totally morally acceptable. It's good. And given the numerous times that the church has actually encouraged sports as actually something really healthy for the human condition, most sports have an element of juking or deception that goes on that's within the realm of play that's totally acceptable.
Well, let me ask you this then, Joe. Is because you said some theologians say that, and I don't know if I really like those theologians. They may be right, but like that would mean like April Fool's Day is just a day of sin.
But very, very minor sins.
What? Well, minor sin, though, you know what? We're going for zero sin, Joe. We're not
just going to
kind of hold it down. We're trying to go for zero. So mm-hmm. I can't be like, you like, saying things that are not true on April Fool's Day?
I mean, they would say yes. They would say you shouldn't say them even then. Now, again, it's a different thing. Like, you can still trick people if you're not out and out lying. You just have to be a little more clever about it. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, if you're very clearly in the context of making a joke or making a prank or something like that. But yeah, like a big area this comes up is actually like surprise parties. You know, you say, you know, you don't have to say, we are going to go to your surprise party now. The question is like, is that a lie? And it doesn't seem like that's because theologians disagree on it. And because there are just bigger moral issues, that's not a hill I'm prepared to die on in terms of don't throw people surprise parties.
But you can throw a change up. That's okay.
Yes.
All right. All right, Theo.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you very much, Theo. The number is 888-318-7884. We got time, so let's see how the phones are working. Let's go to Scott in Nebraska watching on YouTube. Scott, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yeah, let me first say I just finished Joe's book, and I give it 5 stars. Great book.
Really? Which one was it? The Pope Peter
understand.
One?
Yes.
5 stars, Joe.
Thank you. I really do appreciate that a lot.
The sacrifice of the Mass is still something that I grapple with. If Jesus, of course he did, when he rose to heaven, he's interceding as our great high priest on the basis of who he is and his sacrifice that he made. And I wonder what is the point of having a priest called Alter Christus offering that sacrifice to God when it's already been offered. I can understand, I believe in the real presence and all of that, but I just wonder, what is the point of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, you're making yourself perfectly clear. I'm sure you're not the only person listening who has that question as well. This is actually one of the big dividing lines during the Reformation is the Reformers universally reject the idea of the sacrifice of the Mass, even those who have a kind of high Eucharistic theology like Luther, all the way down to those like Zwingli who have a very low Eucharistic theology. The one thing that unites them is all of them say, you can't call it a sacrifice. You can't call what we're doing at church the sacrifice of the Mass, because Christ sacrificed himself once for all. That misunderstands two things. One, like what the nature of the sacrifice is, and two, kind of the whole history of Christianity. And I know that sounds really strange, but I want to give a little bit of background. I just wrote a chapter on this for a book that's coming out soon called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. And it traces in there how the Reformers were actually aware that the universal belief of Christianity before them was that the Mass was a sacrifice. And Luther and Calvin both say just as much. Calvin claims the devil deceived almost the whole world. And both Luther and Calvin acknowledge explicitly that this is the universal belief of Christians up until the 16th century, that this is what the early Christians believed. So then the question is, well, why did they believe that? And you see the foundation of it as far back as places like Malachi in the Old Testament. Malachi 1, verse 11 says that from the rising of the sun to its setting, my name is great among the nations, and every place incense is offered to my name and a pure offering. That word offering can also be rendered sacrifice. So it's this idea that there's a New Testament prophecy in the Old Testament that that there's going to be universally sacrifice offered to God in every nation all over the world, and that the Catholic Church is the fulfillment of this prophecy. But then you flash forward to the Last Supper, and Jesus says, do this in remembrance of me. So when he says that, he doesn't just mean like, here's the body and blood separated from any kind of sacrificial aspect, right? This is the blood poured out for you. Like, this is the sacrificial blood. Matthew 26, verse 28. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Like, that kind of idea that he is explicitly telling them, do this, meaning offer this sacrifice. So this gets us to the heart of the question. Every day, priests offer the sacrifice of Christ. They are not re-sacrificing Christ. They're offering the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ and joining with it the sacrifice of our prayers, which is why we bring forward the bread and wine, which we describe in the prayer as the work of human hands, and then God transforms that. So our prayers and our sacrifices are united to Christ's perfect sacrifice, and all of that is offered to the Father. The last thing I'd say is that all of this is paralleled in the Old Testament liturgy of Passover. That Passover happened on two distinct days. You had Preparation Day, when the lamb was killed, and then you had the actual Feast of Unleavened Bread, the first day of which, Passover meal, you eat the lamb. So those two were two halves of one sacrifice. If you went for a second course, because you couldn't leave any until morning, so if you ate more, you weren't re-sacrificing the lamb. You were just re-participating in the one sacrifice. You see what I mean? So the church will sometimes describe this as the bloody and the unbloody sacrifice. That Preparation Day, the killing of the lamb, that was foreshadowing Good Friday. But the eating of the lamb, which is part of the sacrificial action, that is prefiguring Holy Thursday evening, and also prefiguring every Mass throughout all of history. Now, that's a lot of kind of sacrificial theology to kind of throw out. So I don't know if that helps or not.
Yeah, I wonder if you'd have a recommendation for a book or a chapter in a book that might go into a bit more.
Well, this fall, I'll be releasing a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, and an entire chapter that traces the history and theology of that question.
So call us back and we'll send you a copy of it. Scott, thanks for, you gave him a 5-star review on Pope Peter. So, maybe we can get you a free copy of this one. But we got to take a quick break, right back with more Joe Heschmeyer, Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is underwritten with support from Homeschool Connections. Teens and parents, Homeschool Connections invites you to the Life After High School online conference, October 7th to 8th. With information on Catholic universities, trade schools, and religious vocations, plus workshops. CatholicHomeschoolConference.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being with us. We really do appreciate that you take the time and hang out with us here, Catholic Answers Live. And or maybe you're listening later on the podcast version. Either way, we're happy you're here. If you'd like to call, 888-318-7884 is the number. It's open forum today. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And earlier we lost contact, probably because we're having all kinds of phone issues, which seem to be straightened out now. Lisa in Mounds, Oklahoma called earlier, and she's back. Lisa, thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, it was the phone. I agree with the 5-star review on Pope Peter. That was a really good book. Thanks for writing it.
Oh, thank you.
So my question is about John the Baptist. When he was in prison, he sent his, emissaries to Jesus apostles saying, you know, go find out if he's the one we are really looking for, or should we be looking for someone else? And, you know, Jesus sent back a response saying, well, you tell John the Baptist that, you know, the dead are raised, the sick are cured, and the blind see. But why did John the Baptist ask that question? Like, he baptized Jesus and their cousins. Like, doesn't he know who Jesus is?
Yeah, that is a great and mysterious question. And I know that in the book, The Lord, Romano Guardini spends, I don't know, maybe 10 pages kind of exploring the mystery of that. So some people will say that he says it for the disciples of John, that basically that John, knowing that his time on earth is drawing to an end, is helping to transition his followers to make them Jesus's followers. Basically, he knew from the beginning that he was coming to prepare the way for the Messiah. And so rather than just telling them himself, this is the Messiah, although we see from John 1 that he all but does that, he says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. You know, he just says, behold, the Lamb of God. But, you know, he gives that sense of, like, here's the Messiah. And then he gives some other hints, like after Jesus' baptism. But then to make it from Jesus' own mouth, one interpretation is that he sends them to go and find this out. That's a good interpretation. Guardini actually rejects that and says that, no, that there's a sense in which he's asking to be kind of comforted, to make sure that he hasn't given his life for nothing. Not necessarily a moment of doubt, but like a moment of just kind of like asking to be reassured. There's something mysterious about the whole life and ministry of John the Baptist. Like, he isn't chosen as an apostle. He's left to be the forerunner. And so he seems to be trying to figure out his own role in part. And so Guardini ends up by saying, well, the Jesus' response, he says, blessed is he who is not scandalized in me. That there's actually a real gentle kind of reassurance that Jesus is giving him here, knowing, like, John has a really difficult role to play in the story of salvation. He's not invited to become an apostle, but he ends up still being a martyr for Christ without ever getting all of the kind of reassurance of getting to walk with Jesus in this way. That Jesus is comforting him kind of in that moment when things are probably very confusing and very dark for him.
Thank you. I'm glad that I'm not the only one that finds that mysterious.
Oh, yes. Lots of people have. Oh, by the way, if you give Joe's book, Pope Peter, a 5-star review, do read Romano Guardini's book, The Lord. It's just one of the greats.
I will. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's one of the greats. Wouldn't you say, Joe? I mean, it's really a classic.
You're going to give it at least 6 or 7 stars.
Yeah, you're going to have to invent more stars. Because if you gave, I mean, Joe's a very good writer. But if you give Joe 5 stars, Romano, I don't know why I'm having so much trouble saying his name. Romano Guardini is going to get a lot of stars from you. Thanks, Lisa. Let's see, where are we going now? We're going to we're going to Jay in Ohio, listening on 88.1 FM. Jay, we're glad you called. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yeah, I have a question about taking the Lord's name in vain. I come from like a long line of German Catholics, and ever since I can remember, all of my family, and including me to this day, if we screw up or we drop a really expensive tool, we'll, you know, yell out Jesus Christ or...
Don't say the other one.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure we didn't. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. And a lot of people will be like, well, you're taking the Lord's name in vain. And I'll be like, well, am I? Because what's vanity? To me, it would be like taking on the Lord's name, saying you're a follower in Christ, but making everything about you. And then when I do say, like, GD it, aren't I really asking God to take whatever I just did, that screw up or whatever, and putting it as far away from me, from him, since damnation, hell, is the farthest, you know, you can kind of go from God's presence. Aren't I saying, hey, get this out of my life? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. Joe, go ahead.
I would say this. I think you're right to see it as bigger than that. Like, when the second commandment talks about taking the name of the Lord in vain, it's not just saying, here's a list of words not to use, But there is a sense in which we do want to be respectful of the name of the Lord. So the Catechism in paragraph 2146 forbids every improper use of the names of God, Jesus Christ, but then also even the Virgin Mary and the saints. And that sounds really strange because you think, well, they're not God, so why would this extend to them? But in the book of Acts, we hear about an accusation that the apostles engaged in blasphemy against, I think it was Moses. And so there was this idea that, like, you could actually eat, like, the Jewish understanding. Acts 6, verse 11 said that we heard Stephen speak words of blasphemy against Moses and against God, that to speak ill of God, to speak ill even of the saints, is a violation of the Ten Commandments. That's at the heart of it. So trivially using the name of God, especially in anger, is something I would steer far clear of. But I would also recognize that this is about more than that, that using the name of God in a trivial way. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, if you're legitimately praying in those moments saying, like, Lord, I've really screwed up and I'm mad and I want to, you know, please take this from me, maybe just say those words instead rather than the examples that you gave. It's not always clear from the outside if someone is cursing or offering kind of an angry prayer. But we don't put yourself in a situation where that question has to be asked, would be what I'd say. But then also, like you said, like, remember the broader context. Don't do anything in which you trivialize the name of God, you know, needlessly swearing an oath or making Christianity look ridiculous by invoking God when he shouldn't be invoked. Anything like that is going to be contrary to the name of the Lord.
Jay, I'm going to leave it there. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the call, and thank you for being careful with your language. I appreciate that. Let's go to Joseph in Rochester, New York. Joseph, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you for receiving my call. I had a question about the COVID vaccine, and I'm sure you're probably bored with people asking you about that. But I was listening to another show and someone was suggesting that maybe, you know, the church or Pope Francis got it right with encouraging people to get the current vaccine. And, you know, it's controversial, obviously, because it was deployed very quickly, but also because of the use of fetal cells. But no one ever talks about childhood vaccines that are made with fetal cells that children, Catholic children, are getting every day, like for varicella, chickenpox, or German measles, or rubella. So is it a political issue, or how much of is it a moral issue? Like, where are these people when...
Yeah, well, Joseph, I'm gonna let Joe answer you, but I just want to let you know something, because long before COVID, here on Catholic Answers, if there was any mention of vaccines, say we had Father Tad on, the ethicist, the bioethicist, and someone brought up a vaccine, that's all people wanted to talk about for the rest of the hour, because this has actually been, especially in pro-life circles, something of a major controversy for a long time. And there have been people who refused to have their children vaccinated for that reason. Now, that's not what the Vatican instructed us to do, but that is what many people chose to do. So I just want to say that, because it doesn't sound like you are aware of that, but we're in a place like this, we're very aware of it, because we've had hundreds and hundreds of questions before anybody ever heard the word COVID. Would you just say again then, what was your specific question for Joe?
I was just wondering, like, why that was. Like, so maybe it's new to me is the answer. But and then should we then not be getting these vaccines? Then kind of the other question that I'm not asking is,
right,
did the church get it wrong by encouraging the vaccine? And maybe.
Great questions.
You don't want to answer
I
don't know.
No.
We're happy to answer.
Okay. I want to echo what Cy said. Like, the vaccine. So to get just a little bit down the road, the cell line called HEK293, which comes from an embryonic kidney cell, human embryonic kidney cells, which is what the HEK stands for. There's a cell line, meaning they take these cells from the baby and then they replicate those cells over and over and over again. That's been going on since 1973. They're not killing new children, and they're not, like, directly using the original kidney or anything like that, but they are using the cells from the kidney, which they're then replicating. And for a lot of reasons, drug companies have long used this because it's easier than like animal testing is more reliable. And so you're right, like they're used in all sorts of stuff. They're used in Tylenol, they're used in Tums, Benadryl, Claritin, Mucinex. But there are a lot of pro-lifers who are really uneasy with that, who say, we'll just forego all of that. That's a question in conscience. It's not something you're required to do because you're not directly participating in the evil of the abortion.
And we'll have to leave it there. You can probably hear the music. So we got to take a quick break. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Joseph. You're always welcome here. We'll take a quick break. And more questions for Joe Heschmeyer on Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Johnette Williams. We bring you the truth of the Catholic faith on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Just had a question about vaccines. Going to have another question about vaccines now because I know there's more Joe would like to say about it. So we'll go to John in Portland, Oregon, watching on YouTube. John, you got a question about the vaccines?
Yep.
All right.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Oh, very happy to.
So I see a very big seeming disconnect between bishops in the U.S. and the conservative Orthodox Catholic community of my friends and family in my hometown in Illinois. When speaking on COVID, masks, vaccines, both on the morality issue of the vaccines and other aspects. And I'm wondering, what do I make of this disconnect? What parts of the bishop's statements do I have to believe and follow as apostolic authority, and which statements are just the bishop's personal opinions, possibly guided by the government funding in dioceses that had to accept COVID relief money? And like, what, can I just follow my conscience or in this confusion?
Okay, John, thank you.
That's a really good question. I think a few things I'd say there. I don't think you need to ascribe bad motives to, like, it's possible if there is just like a prudential thing that a bishop says, that maybe you and the bishop just don't see eye to eye, and it may not be like he's being paid off by the government or anything like that. In terms of the kind of the moral status regarding vaccination, I would really encourage you to read two documents. One of them is an older document in which the Pontifical Academy for Life, I believe it was, has a document, and it's just entitled Moral Reflections on Vaccines Prepared from Cells Derived from Aborted Human Fetuses. It's not a very short title, so I'll give it again. Moral Reflections on Vaccines Prepared from Cells Derived from Aborted Human Fetuses. And in this, the theologians actually explain the different moral principles that are at play here, as well as places in which prudence comes into play. And so one of the things they point out is that where there is a morally clean, so to speak, alternative vaccine, we have a grave responsibility to use that, as well as to make a conscientious objection to those with which we have a moral problem. That doesn't mean that we can never take vaccines produced that use embryonic cells in some way in the process. A lot of times the connection is very remote, but we should strive for better. Like, we don't want to put people in this kind of situation. The other document that I would really encourage is a much more recent one from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. This is in the realm of magisterial teaching. It says, note on the morality of using some anti-COVID-19 vaccines. And they're building off of what the Pontifical Academy for Life said on that. And one of the things that they talk about is that even though it is morally acceptable to get vaccinated, at the same time, practical reason makes evident that vaccination is not, as a rule, a moral obligation, and that therefore it must be voluntary. So they're clear that getting vaccinated can be a moral good and one that we should take seriously, but also they're against something like forcing vaccination on people who, that in such a way that violates conscience. And there are principles that are behind that. There's a general principle about the respect for conscience that forcing someone to do something that they think is evil is morally wrong. You know, forcing a Jewish person to eat pork is wrong, even if it's not actually immoral to eat pork. Like, to force someone to violate their conscience isn't right. Now, there are times where those kind of things are legitimately unavoidable, but still, as a rule, we want to avoid anything like that. So I don't know if that helps, but I would say looking to those things, you'll get the clear principles that are at play. And I think I would trust those more than someone who's maybe well-intentioned but less informed on the question.
John, I'm interested in your response.
So my question was not so much about the abortion issue, but more about the authority of the statements that the bishops are saying. Like, if my diocese mandates masks, is the authority of that order of episodic authority on pain of sin, or is it equivalent to Walmart telling me to mask up to buy groceries and I should just be charitable to the customers and put my mask on?
I see. Yeah, no, it's much more like the latter, in that a bishop who says, in my diocese, I require masks at Mass, is not saying the faith delivered once for all to the apostles says something one way or the other about wearing a mask. It's trying to make a decision in practical reason based on moral principles. So I apologize. I misunderstood kind of the nature of your questions. We have a general duty to obey our moral leaders. Hebrews 13:17 says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they're keeping watch over your souls as men who will have to give account. Let them do this joyfully and not sadly, for that would be of no advantage to you. So we should be enthusiastically obedient to our bishops and to our pastors within the realm of what we can morally say yes to. If they ever tell you to do something you morally can't do, which I think is a remote possibility, you would have to say no then. But short of that, you should obey. And Hebrews even says to, you know, let them lead you joyfully and not sadly, or else you're taking away the merit that you'd be receiving from a joyful obedience yourself. That doesn't mean you can't voice your objections, or that you can't voice your concerns and maybe have a conversation with your pastor or even with your bishop. But it just means, as a general rule of thumb, we should be guided by that, even in these areas of prudence where two different bishops might go different directions.
John, thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity to have a little bit of conversation about that, because it's a little bit of a patchwork now. Different bishops doing different things as far as they should, I imagine. I mean, we're not in the same condition everywhere in the United States or even in every county in my state and in different places around the world. So I'm sure there should be different responses from different bishops. But very worthy questions, and we're not tired of the COVID questions at all. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We're going to go to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho now, listening on the EWTN app. Mike in Coeur d'Alene, go ahead with your question.
Hi. My question is, I called in a week ago or something like that, 8-9 days ago. I've been chatting with a Jehovah's Witness over the phone, and you guys answered the question about if Adam and Eve were had sin, they'd still be on the earth alive. And then she asked a question after she called back, and she was talking about the celestial battle. And I tried to look up, but she was saying that the celestial battle between the angels and Satan happened after Adam and Eve were placed on the earth. And I don't know why, I thought that it had been before. So that's kind of my question.
Okay.
Yeah, it did happen before. Okay, so it's kind of a tricky question because it's getting into the whole way that like spiritual beings experience time, which is already kind of a loaded question in one sense, that they're not like in the timeline in the same way you and I are. And there's a whole interaction with time and matter that both scientists and theologians kind of poke at that's kind of confusing and strange, that they're in what Aquinas would call sempiternity, where it's not eternity, but there is a before and after. But there's a spiritual realm where it's not like the way you and I experience time. Having said that, we do know two things. Number one, in Genesis 3, the devil tempts Adam and Eve. If the devil was an unfallen angel, he wouldn't do that. And number two, in Revelation 12, if you follow the timeline, it says that the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He's thrown down, and then you see that after he is thrown down, verse 13, he then pursues the woman who'd born the male child, that this, the opposition to the human race, to the woman and her offspring, which is prophesied in Genesis 3, that all happens after the fall. So it seems pretty clear from both Genesis 1 to 3, or really 2 to 3, and Revelation 12, that this is prior in some sense to the fall of Adam and Eve, because an unfallen angel isn't going to cause the fall of man.
Okay, Mike?
What were the chapters in Revelation? I got Genesis 2 and 3, but what was Revelation?
Yeah, Revelation 12 has a really fascinating account of the devil kind of being thrown down and then tempting the woman. You'll have to read it to kind of see what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Mike, we have a book. I was just thinking, Mike, we might want to, if you want the book, we have a book called 20 Answers Jehovah's Witnesses. So, and you've been having this dialogue with the Jehovah's Witness. If you'd like the book, hang on the line. I'm going to go to a break because I got to go to a break. But hang on the line if you'd like that 20 Answers Jehovah's Witnesses. Might help you in those conversations. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The World Over with Rima DeRoyo. Coverage as seen through a Catholic lens.
All people of faith and sincerity need to awaken to this and protect this fundamental right of religious liberty.
Expert analysis.
Does Revelation judge history, or does history judge Revelation?
Stories vital to people of faith.
It's part of our faith that comedy and tragedy naturally go hand in hand.
Delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up today. Go to EWTN.com/worldover.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, 888-318-7884, our number. We're going to kind of do the lightning round here because we're getting close to the end. We'll try to get as many folks on as we can. We'll start with John in New York watching on YouTube. Hi, John. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. I was just wondering, obviously, the Catholic Church doesn't do anathemas anymore and like the services for an anathema. And I was wondering why the church doesn't do that, and if the church still has something in place that does the same thing an anathema does, or something like
that. Yeah, that's a great question. Short answer is the Second Vatican Council didn't have any anathemas in it, but the First Vatican Council in 1870 did. Those are the last two ecumenical councils. So one of the two did, one of the two didn't. It's hard to say what the next one would do. The reason Vatican II didn't have anathemas is that the nature of it was pastoral. Partly, it's like this. They were not dealing with people who were already bought in, where it was enough to say, hey, if you believe this thing, you're no longer a well-formed Catholic and you're putting your soul at risk, because the people to whom they're trying to reach largely didn't believe in Catholic things anymore in the first place. So they're trying to say, okay, what can we say positively? Like, where's the common ground that we can go from there? So the kind of nature and the tone is different because they're not dealing with the same kind of foundation. You know, like in the same way that if you're dealing with a non-Christian, it's not going to be very convincing to say, well, what you believe is contrary to the Bible. If you're dealing with a fellow Christian, that works a lot better. So the anathemas, I don't think they made sense in the context of Vatican II. But in the context of like within the church kind of stuff, you still see that kind of stuff. You'll have the condemnation of specific books or even like the work of specific theologians that's ongoing. It often doesn't like make huge headlines because a lot of it is stuff that you've never even read and is much more like particular to the realm of like theology departments. But the church still definitely has a role and sees herself having a role at saying, if you believe this thing, you're cutting yourself off from divine life, or you're cutting yourself off from communion with the church or from orthodoxy.
All right. Is that okay, John?
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, I just wanted to ask one more thing. That's related to it. If the church needed to anathematize somebody, could they still do it, or have they just completely abolished that?
Oh, no, they haven't abolished that, and they haven't repudiated the anathemas that have been given. And so if someone was just publicly heretical, they can still do things like excommunicate people and do everything that they were doing with anathema clauses before, where they anathematized ideas. And so both ideas and particular people are still called out as being out of line with the Catholic faith. You can find not long ago, for instance, Bishop Fabian Breskowitz up in Nebraska in the Diocese of Lincoln excommunicated everyone who was involved with Planned Parenthood, or I believe even the Society of St. Pius X, the Euthanasia Society up there. Like he really came down hard and said, if you have 2 weeks to sever connection with these groups, and if you don't, you're excommunicated. That authority still exists. Not every bishop is as quick to kind of issue that, but it is an authority the church has, and for good reason.
John, thanks. I'm going to keep moving, see who else we can get to here before we have to go. Let's go to Noel in Maryland, watching on Facebook. Noel, you there with us?
Yes, I'm here. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Nice to hear you again. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Thank you. Well, my question is, I get really confused about the origins of Jesus Christ, because I've heard Bishop Barron talking about filiation. So was he all from all eternity with the Father? Was he created, or was he born?
Great question. He is the Son of God from all eternity. He does not originally have a human nature. He's a divine person, and then he takes on a human nature. And this story is told very clearly in the first chapter of the Gospel of John. It says, in the beginning was the Word. That's Jesus, the Logos, the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So then you have that. Then you drop down to verse 14. It says, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father. So Jesus is a divine person who in the incarnation takes on a human nature. And so he is born in time, in his humanity. And we can speak of him being born, so to speak, from all eternity in his divinity.
I got you. Thank you so much.
All right. Great. I appreciate that. I hope we'll hear from you again. I'd like to hear Bishop Barron talking about filiation. I love divine filiation. It's one of my favorite things about being Catholic.
If anyone's interested in that idea, we kind of touched on that in our Friday conversation last week, didn't we?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm sure we did. It just means being made sons and daughters of the living God. That's all. Just a little thing like that.
That's all.
Timothy in Washington, watching on YouTube, you are up next.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
And the question I have, I'm 73 years old, and prior to Vatican II, only the priest could touch the host. But now, since Vatican II, they changed the Mass. Now everyone touches holes. And I was wondering, it looks like they've de-emphasized the Mass. The Mass used to be high up. Now it's kind of mixed in with everything that's going on today. It seems very simple. It's in English. And everyone now, you got women up on the altar. And I was just wondering, basically, why now it's okay to touch the holes. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I want to clarify one thing. That's not actually a change that Vatican II either permitted or required. That's something that originally was an American innovation. The U.S. permitted it in 1971, and then they wrote to the Vatican. The Congregation for Sacraments said they could do that, to have lay people assist the priest in distributing communion. And then Pope Paul VI in 1973 extended that permission to the Universal Church. And he cited basically the idea that, like, present day conditions had changed, both because this was one means by which some people were being nourished in terms of their own spirituality. But I think the other thing is that there was perceived to be more of a need because of the decline of priests. I don't know if that was one of the things motivating him or not. But certainly in subsequent things the church has talked about, the use of extraordinary ministers is usually when there aren't enough ordinary ministers, that there aren't enough priests and deacons to handle the number of people at Mass in a timely way. But despite that, the church has constantly stressed that extraordinary ministers should be well-formed, so they're reverent. They should be reverent in their attire and in their demeanor, and, of course, most of all, in kind of their view of who Jesus is in the Eucharist. And unfortunately, in some places, in some parishes, that isn't always lived out very well, which I think leads people to get kind of frustrated with the idea of extraordinary ministers.
What do you think, Timothy?
Oh, it answers a lot of questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. I feel like that Timothy is expressing something that many people feel, that the sense of the Mass in even though it's beautifully celebrated in many places, I think even the Pope was talking about this summer, that there is a reverence that seems to be missing. And it's not all just about the accoutrements, you know, it's not all just about the atmosphere and all that. Somehow we're less reverent at Mass.
I think there is this so-called spirit of Vatican II, that people thought Vatican II just blew the doors open and said, you know, basically flower power. And so you have this kind of revolution in how people viewed their relationship to God and to the church. There's a fascinating firing line with one of the representatives of the USCCB from, I don't know, maybe 1980, where he's talking about how before there'd been a strong emphasis on the transcendence of God, and they were trying to focus on the immanence, and not just on the relationship with God, but with the relationship to other people. All of those are valid theological kind of questions to tackle, But if you don't handle them well, and I think history has shown we didn't handle them well, that can easily go sideways into something where it feels much more like a potluck than the worship of God. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit and calling it a potluck, but you see what I mean? Like something much more about like you and I affirming one another than us offering right worship to the living God.
Yeah.
And one of those issues is just like, what is the Mass about? And the Mass isn't first and foremost about person-to-person kind of unity. There's that element. It's present. Like the sign of peace is there, but it has to be rooted in a strong Eucharistic spirituality that then redounds to the communion within the church in the other sense.
Yeah, but when you say that about the kind of potluck thing, one of the things that I think that does happen is we're so close to it sometimes that we lose our perspective. And when you kind of step back and go, it got really bad in the 1970s. And even though I was a kid, I can remember some of the we're fumbling and bumbling our way into being more reverent. I do think bit by bit we're getting there.
I've seen a lot of really concrete things. A lot of churches that are, you know, church by church, kind of parish by parish, you see that shift where there's a growing sense. You know, if a third of Catholics believe in the real presence, maybe that's the crisis that needs to be solved.
Yeah.
Not just that people aren't having as much fun or they're not hearing the music they're familiar with or fill in the blank. Like the concern to me is like the lack of reverence is hurting us. And I think people are aware of that. I think that we are seeing some changes there.
Christopher in Los Angeles, listening on the Catholic Answers app. You're next. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, how you doing, Joe? God bless you guys.
Thank you.
Quick question. Thank you. One of the quick questions is, how do we know what verses we have liberty to interpret and which verses are already defined? A good example of this would be, like, for example, Jeremiah 29:11, you know, it says, "For I know I have plans for you," things like that, says the Lord. Was he saying this specific? Can we use this verse for everyone, or was he specifically saying this to a certain person?
That's a great question. Well, he's specifically saying that to Israel about the captivity, that they're going to have 70 years of hard exile in Babylon, but not to despair because God still has good things planned for them. But even knowing that immediate context, we could say, well, okay, if that's true of Israel, if that's true of the people in exile, what does that say about the nature of God and what can I draw from that? That sense in which let me step back and answer your question in two parts. First, the church usually doesn't say this verse means X. And even in the handful of cases where she does do that, that doesn't mean that it couldn't also mean something else in addition. She's not saying the only thing God means by this is this, because you can't really limit God in that way. So if I said, what are the meanings of the parable of the prodigal son? That list could go on forever. And there's more and more things you can draw out of it. You can read the same passage multiple times and come away with a fresh sense of it. But the second thing is that the guardrails are orthodoxy. If you're reading a passage in such a way that it contradicts what the church believes and what Christians have always believed, that's a sign that your interpretation is wrong. That doesn't mean, you know, it only means one thing and nothing else, but it does mean there's some things that it doesn't mean. You know, if you take that to mean I should, you know, the verse in Jeremiah to mean I should put other people in exile, that's probably a bad read. It doesn't seem to fit neatly with Christianity. And then the final thing is there are what are called the four senses of Scripture, where you look first at the literal sense, which just means who is this written to and what were they saying to them? And then you look at the other spiritual senses where you can say, what's the moral sense? How should I live? Are there anagogical or analogical senses where it's like foretelling something about Christ? And then is there a sense in which it's foretelling the story of the church? So to take one example with this, the parting of the Red Sea and the journey of the people of Israel on the Exodus. Now, in one sense, it's describing a historical thing. In another sense, it's foretelling even the journey of the church through the waters of baptism towards the promised land. But then there may be other ways in which it applies to you personally, where God's led you out of the place of slavery into a place of freedom. So we don't want to limit to say it only means X and nothing else.
Christopher, we've got to leave it there. That's the end for today. Tomorrow, join us. We're going to be live from right outside the ballroom at the Catholic Answers National Conference. finally doing it after 2 years. Joe will be there. And we're going to have... it'll be Tim and Trent on the air to start tomorrow. And then, Joe, you'll be on Friday, on the big show on Friday. We'll see you then.
All right.
And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.